This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. What should the government be looking at in the name of protecting national security? Should we know what records the government is tracking? University of Wisconsin Professor Alan Rubel's research interests include surveillance and privacy. He will be at Western Michigan University on Wednesday at an event sponsored by the Kircher Center and Western's Department of Sociology. Rubel's address is called What's Wrong with the NSA's Bulk Metadata Collection Program? Alan Rubel, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's begin with that very question. Is there something wrong with the NSA's Bulk Metadata Collection Program? And if so, what is it?
Well, the title of the talk sort of implies that there is something wrong. And I think there's actually a fairly broad consensus that covers the broadest swath of the political spectrum in the United States, that indeed there's something troubling about the NSA's bulk telephone metadata collection that was revealed by Edward Snowden in the middle part of 2013. And what that program involves is the collection by the NSA under the USA Patriot Act, Section 215. It allows the NSA to collect all call information, that is information about phone calls that originate in or are made to or are made within the United States. So information like what phones dial what other numbers, what numbers dial particular phones, time of call. There's some indication that it also tracked information about where calls were placed. And it allowed the NSA to create a large database and to connect lots of people based on who was calling whom in this big mass of records. Okay, so that's the background. And this year, after a big political backlash, the U.S. Congress and the executive passed what's called the USA Freedom Act, which curtails some of these practices in certain ways. And this had broad support. This bill had broad support. But I think that the key thing we need to understand is that this practice of bulk metadata collection is problematic or is wrong or is troubling for particular reasons. And this is what your question is getting at. It's particular reasons. And if we don't really focus on what was wrong with it and why it was wrong, then we won't have learned the right lessons, even though some of the particular practices are set to expire later this year. There are other practices.
Well, what lessons should we learn from it? What are the things that are wrong with the basic idea of the government trying to monitor phone calls and other forms of communication in what is supposed to be an effort to prevent further terrorist activity?
Good. Well, there's a couple things that I want to focus on. And the first is that the way that the bulk metadata collection program took place was through a very aggressive interpretation of Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act. That is, there are requirements under Section 215, which allows for government actors, the FBI, to make business records requests of anyone, and in this case, it included telecommunications companies, and they made business records requests for this call metadata. Now, they can't just request anything. There's a requirement under Section 215 that has to be, quote, relevant to an authorized investigation. And the relevance criteria was that the government used and that the FISA court, the court that meets in secret and okays these orders for business records, the relevance criteria used was exceedingly broad. They said that metadata was relevant to an authorized investigation because having a complete record of all metadata would be really useful in whatever authorized investigation was going on. So it was not a matter of being sort of narrowly relevant. It was relevant because all information is at some point possibly relevant. This is, I think, the big problem, the big thing, and that is that in secret, the government was making an interpretation of the law that was really aggressive. Now, governments do that. Lawyers do that. That's the territory that lawyers or all lawyers operate in, aggressive interpretations of the law. But here, it was very aggressive and also utterly secret. And it was a kind of interpretation that no one could have gathered. And hence, we really had no idea that this was even possible under the law. And I think that's one of the key things, is the pushing or the use of these techniques and these legal interpretations outside of what anybody could reasonably anticipate.
So is it better that we know, even if this data is going to be collected, is it better that we at least know that that is going on? Could you also argue the other side of that, though, that if the government is very transparent and says, hey, look, this is what we're doing, that you're going to encourage people who would attempt to do harm to the United States to try to get around it and to try to find ways to communicate where they won't be spotted, and therefore we don't know when they're plotting to do some great terrorist act on the United States?
That's a really good question, and it's actually, I think there's two questions embedded in there I'd like to distinguish. The first question is whether it's really better for us as individuals to know, and the second is whether there is some strategic reason why it might be better to keep it secret. So I'll answer the first question first, and that is, well, yeah, you know, if we knew we were being spied on, it might actually bother us. We might be worried about it. We might second guess what we do. We might, you know, worry that we're going to be connected to people we might not want to be connected to. That might limit the way we socialize or what have you. And somebody who cared just about the narrow consequences of a program might think, well, we'd be better off if we just didn't know. We'd act more freely. But I think that's a big mistake. And I think that it's a big mistake because personal information, including who we communicate with, is really important to us. And we all are people who can decide for ourselves what matters and make decisions in accordance to our own values. And even information that is discomforting to us is information that we have a very strong claim to know about. And to have something kept secret from us that is so integral to how we go about our daily lives and how we make sense of our world and our political world is an affront to us as adults, as autonomous acting humans. And I think that even if we're better off not knowing, it's bad to keep that information from us. It's disrespectful of who we are as information-using people. So that's kind of the first part. The second part is whether it's actually more effective to have a surveillance program that takes place in secret. And it's very, very hard to make a claim based on evidence here. That is, what kind of study could we possibly show that differentiated between different types of surveillance and their efficacy? And I think that, one, if there were really good evidence that this kind of aggressive, large database collection led to huge increases in security, you know, well, I'd take a look at that and I'd consider that, but I haven't seen it. And that's the kind of thing that you would expect to be used as an argument in favor of the program rather than just sort of vague, hand-wavy stuff about, oh, it being good for security because security-related folks like it. It's easier. And I also think that there's lots of ways in which we value rights, individual rights, even where they may conflict with some other good. We value privacy in the Fourth Amendment sense, even if it might make it easier to enforce, say, narcotics laws by searching all cars on the highway. Well, that's so what? There is a right involved, and sometimes that there's an expense. And I also note that just the sheer number of people who are armed in terrorist acts in the U.S. is vanishingly small. We've had a couple of large attacks, but it's really, in terms of numbers of lives lost, it's much smaller than many other day-to-day activities that are themselves risky, driving a car, for example.
If bulk data is being collected on us, is the concern that at some point it's going to end up being used for something other than the effort to stop terrorism, used to embarrass somebody publicly, used to perhaps prosecute another crime? Are those reasons that we should be safeguarding our privacy?
Absolutely. And this is not speculative. This is not the kind of thing that we lack historical evidence for. So there's a really wonderful article. It's an academic article, but it's a really beautifully written piece by a lawyer and philosopher, Jeremy Waldron, that argues that we really need to distinguish when we talk about security or we talk about being protected or avoiding harms, that we really need to account for many different kinds of harms, including harms not only from, say, external sources or criminal sources, but harms that we would suffer at the hands of state actors. So, historically, in Western political philosophical tradition, there's been a strong worry about the kind of harms that can be imposed by government, and these are real. We have seen that a number of scientists, typically from China or with Chinese ancestry, have been prosecuted for sharing information or for collecting information that turned out not to be criminal, right? So people get watched for, so there's the, I'm forgetting the name, but the physicist at Temple University who was accused of carrying plans for a so-called pocket heater. It turned out that this person was not carrying schematics for something that was a valuable piece of technology. It was something else. And yet he had his life turned upside down and potentially lost his job and potentially is going to be incarcerated for something. And, you know, so people are watched and they can suffer. We've seen also that people get watched and suffer for politically oriented activities. There's a big investigation by the Department of Justice Inspector General on the FBI watching political groups in the run-up to and first couple years of the Iraq War in early 2000s. And they seem to be watching people who were peace activists. And some of the people who were being watched were put on watch lists and had their travel restricted or would undergo lots of questioning for what is really just straight-up First Amendment-protected activity. And that's a worry, because once you're in those kind of positions, it's very difficult to extricate oneself. One's always having an increased likelihood of being prosecuted and harmed as a result. And it can stifle the kind of open and robust and active political discourse that I think is appropriate, that we value in the U.S.
You noted at the beginning that there is some broad consensus that this should be more targeted, scaled back. There should be more checks and balances. But didn't it take a while to reach that point of broad consensus? If we go back to the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, at that time, there was not much resistance to the idea that there should be a greater expansion of government surveillance. Did the time without a terrorist attack allow for the debate to evolve in a way and reach the point where, yes, there are both Republicans and Democrats and some very conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats who have come together on this issue. Did the absence of a large-scale terrorist attacks on the United States allow for some more debate and freedom of expression, I guess, on this issue?
Yeah, I have to believe that it did. I want to push in two places, though. One, I think there was quite a bit of debate and pushback about the Patriot Act and particular provisions within the Patriot Act, including the Section 215 business records provision. There was a fairly robust debate then. And I think that, you know, in the intervening time without large-scale attacks surely has to be part of the reason why it was politically palatable in late 2014 and early 2015 to propose and pass something like the USA Freedom Act. But a big part of it was that the passage of the Freedom Act was the Snowden leaks. It was impossible for anybody to really know what was going on in the NSA surveillance. And only by Snowden's revelations did people realize that, wow, this is an aggressive interpretation of the law. This is done in secret. This is the kind of thing that they are doing, this kind of program that they had. And, you know, we don't know what would have happened if that had been revealed in as stark a way as it was revealed in 2013, say 10 years earlier. You know, would people have balked at that? The kind of anodyne language that you see in a statute doesn't have the real visceral effect that these large leaks by Snowden did. I think that's a big part of it. And finally, you know, I wouldn't discount the fact that, you know, there was a robust opposition to the Obama administration in Congress, and so it gave people some reason to push, not only because of what I really do believe is a sincere belief in protection of civil liberties, but also there was political hay to be made, and the coalitions worked out fairly well.
But again, on the idea of broad consensus and Edward Snowden, last week when he launched a Twitter page, that got some reaction from people calling him a traitor and saying that he was an enemy of the United States and those sort of things. So even if there's broad consensus, is there still some pushback on what Edward Snowden did, even though, as you say, without his actions, we would not be aware of exactly what the NSA was looking at and how much they were collecting?
Yeah, I can hold two positions that may seem somewhat at odds. Yeah, I don't think there's any question that having real legal limits or having real legal repercussions for leaking classified information is something that's important. And I think that, you know, Snowden can be a criminal who did something that is in fact very important for the U.S. And how do I think that? Well, how can I hold those two positions? Well, one is I think that the sorts of penalties that he's exposed to and the sorts of treatment that he's exposed to are possibly very disproportionate to the kind of leaks that he engaged in. So what I mean by that is kind of the isolation and treatment of Chelsea Manning, for example. Solitary confinement, the kind of torturous treatment of her is the kind of thing that Snowden could also expect. And, you know, if it were the case where it was just a matter of potentially criminal prosecution, that might be different. And I think that, you know, that we need to consider exactly what kind of defenses and what kind of potential sanctions there are on people who leak things, not for the harm of the United States, but for potentially the protection of things that we value very deeply.
Alan Rubel, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. It was really nice to chat.
Alan Rubel is a University of Wisconsin professor. His address, called What's Wrong with the NSA's Bulk Metadata Collection Program, will be delivered Wednesday at an event sponsored by the Kircher Center and Western Michigan University's Department of Sociology. You can find a link with more details at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.